Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world. Welcome back for another episode of the Center for Internet Security's podcast series, Cybersecurity Where You Are. It's a pleasure to join you again for another episode, and I got a really special guest for us today. My friend, Tony Rutkowski, a bit of living history of the internet and also one of the most amazing people you're going to meet in technology. Tony, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here and honor.
No, it's great to have you here. And Tony's been, our topic is really about the Center for Internet Security's Controls Ambassador Program. And Tony Rutkowski is one of the members of that. These are the folks that volunteer to carry our flag, our message, you know, interact with the public and help us extend our reach across the entire ecosystem here. But my friend Tony Rutkowski, and we're going to get confused over Tony's here at some point, but Tony has been involved with the work of the Center for Internet Security. Our association goes back to my time at the National Security Agency. And when I say living history of the internet, no kidding, it's the real deal. And it has one of the most amazing careers you could ask for in tech, but also one of the great repositories of stories and issues and opinions and all kinds of the history of it that brought us to where we are today. Tony, so welcome. And how about a little, just give a short bit of your background. No minute or two will do it justice, but if you could share a few tidbits with the audience here.
Sure, that's a little hard, but a kid who grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and then decided to embark on this career that included an engineer, lawyer. I worked on the Apollo space program. I was part of the launch team, and my first cybersecurity project was dealing with the computer that actually controlled the Saturn V launches, and then segued to working a bit on the shuttle system, and then became an elective city official. I got interested in the law. I started writing regulatory standards guidelines, and then went to the Federal Communications Commission for a biggest chunk, continuous chunk of my career, and kept on changing positions. Basically got me engaged with a whole array of telecommunications, digital network developments, for which I was responsible. And then left there, became editor-in-chief of Telecommunications Magazine up in Boston, taught part-time at MIT. I had been teaching part-time at New York Law School because I had added a law degree to my BSCE, and then decided to I got an offer I couldn't refuse to move to Geneva and become the Secretary General's counselor at the ITU in Geneva, and that got me involved in some more internet developments, digital television developments, a whole array of developments, including writing a cybersecurity treaty in 1988. That basically didn't go anywhere, if it had, would actually have blessed the NSA's SDNS program. So there's a whole bunch of things that sort of didn't happen. Then I jumped ship again, came back, and went to work for Sprint International to start up a whole bunch of domestic internet stuff. Started up the Internet Society. Started up the Agent Society, started up the Internet Law and Policy Forum. I spent a lot of my time basically kind of spanning venues as well as blending technology and law and regulations. Then went to took over the Internet Society for 2 years. Then went to work for General Magic for several years. Then went to work for SAIC and VeriSign. And then finally decided to basically consult for myself for in the space, essentially evangelizing the controls, which is what I've been doing for the most part of the last 10 years.
Yeah. So, the audience might conclude that, hey, this guy can't hold a job. But actually, that's an extraordinary run. And, you know, we could do a year's worth of episodes just on your involvement in, no joke, the history of technology and the Internet. So we'll save that for another day.
Sure.
But it's always been fascinating because you've operated, in and out in this complex ecosystem, right? Technology, public policy, international relations, standards, it's one big spectrum of activity that's amazing. And it's been a great partner for us and an asset helping us think through some of these things. You know, there's a tendency to think of cybersecurity as primarily a technology issue, but there's certainly technology at the core of it, right? But good technology that isn't reinforced with public policy, is not embedded in the expectations of how things get built through standards or, sort of embedded in the sort of social fabric, is just technology. And so being able to navigate that is just extraordinary. And I think it's been great. So you mentioned the controls. So tell me about sort of how you got involved with that, or because you were doing this on your own, right? You really kind of jumped on the ideas and just took off. And
the problem set that the controls address, which is how you bring about reasonable cybersecurity in a network, is one that's persisted a long time. Actually, in a way, it goes back to, for example, the Federal Communications Commission. This was one of their roles as to how you do that in public networks. And I for a while, was responsible for the technology policy. So if you will, we embedded very judiciously what were controls for telecommunications networks or early digital networks in the regulations. And that necessitated basically trying to discover who's doing what everywhere in all these different venues, domestically and internationally. And so there are bits and pieces of what are sort of the controls that have long existed. But it was the agency that is part of a continuum that we've discussed that goes back literally to 1965, 66 timeframe. And had sort of put in places the foundations for the controls that then really kind of took effect fully 20 years ago with the work you were doing. So I happened into that arena it was probably, I guess, around 2005, 2006, when I started working on efforts to bring what were sort of pieces of the controls into the International Telecommunication Union as standards. That didn't sort of work out so well. It's one of the multiple venues who sort of did bits and pieces of the controls, but there's what you did, in terms of IAD, putting them all together, and then subsequently bringing them to the world through CIS is what's really important. And so now that I'm in my 80s. Deciding what I'm going to sort of do with the rest of my life, this is something I want to spend my time on because it's worth it.
Oh, we're absolutely honored. Yeah. And many of the listeners know the story. You know, for me, I came at it as a security testing guide primarily, right? Vulnerability analysis for defense, and looked at the observations and watching how we just kept finding the same problems over and over again and try to bring it to a pragmatic, prioritized, you know, and the world of like standards and government guidance and so forth, right? Had created these monstrously complex, you know, catalogs and frameworks and all this kind of stuff that just seemed to overwhelm rather than to inform. And so, you know, if I'd have known how big this would become, I might, you know, I just wasn't that smart. I was just trying to help people prioritize, right? Based upon the experience of NSA red teams and blue teams. If you don't know where to begin, start here. I mean, that was the question that was echoing through my head. And when we start to pull, you know, I started to grab some really smart people and say, look, let's not try to solve world hunger. Let's focus in on what's the foundation of good defense. How do people get started? But, you know, you referenced some of the foundations of computer security, right? And we've often talked about the sort of early works that hold up amazingly well, that establishes the principles of security. And I told you my story. I'm about 10 years behind you, Tony. But I started my first assignment at the National Security Agency. They handed me a cardboard carton full of papers, right? Printed papers. Hey, read this stuff. Well, you've named all those papers and then some. You know, that was my starting point. Like, what are these things? The concepts, right, of memory management and protection and principles of security, you know, were, I think, well established, right? I mean, you know, that's a point you've made often, which is the ideas were really pioneered by some of the folks, and quite a bit of it came from the National Security Agency and work around there. But that's really held up, right? And what it took me a while it took me maybe a couple of decades though to recognize the importance of those, of that carton full of papers, and to see it in practical terms, right? And that's the way I look at it. Is like, boy, the seeds of that were planted when I first started, but it took me a while to sort of translate it into the work. You know, I sort of didn't think of it that way till I really faced that problem of why aren't things getting better? We don't have to do it, you know, and that was the revelation for me. So you became our their advocate for that, which was amazing, and that reconnected us. We had some association back at NSA, you know, on some work that I think we were both thinking about at that time.
Sure,
but the idea
marvelous Sagerism, by the way, I think is the fog of more.
The fog of more. Yes, I got more mileage out of that talk for the listener, the audience here. After I retired, I was looking for a topic for a talk to give it at RSA, and I was trying to convey, you know, in a straightforward way, the complexity, that thing I just mentioned, right? There's solutions out there, but people are overwhelmed, you know, by marketing hype and confusion and gigantic catalogs, and I was looking for a way to convey that, and I look over my bookshelf, and there's a book, Lifting the Fog of War. And the fog of war term goes back to Clausewitz and, you know, military strategy and theory and so forth. But there was a book, and I forget, it was I believe Navy Admiral that wrote it, but it was talking about the high risk decision making, i.e. war fighting in the emerging information age, was the way we talked about it back then. And the idea was the government was now flooded with, you know, you were watching wars live on CNN, where, you know, commercial sources are competing for attention with government unique sources. And it was this confusion, right? We were overwhelmed by it. And I looked over and said, that's our problem. It's the fog of more. It's not that we don't have resources. It's that there's so many and the hype is so high, the confusion is so great, people can't get started. And during that swirl of time, which led to things like the controls, that was the revelation to me, that we don't need to create new solutions. We need to help people's attention get focused. And as you said, the roots of those controls go back to the very earliest days of computer security. You know, and that was astounding when you pointed that out. You pointed me right to those papers.
Although arguably even so, when I worked in Geneva, I would go down into the basement where the archives were, and read the documents of the meetings of these. They were dealing with the electrical internet, as it was told, and they had essentially some of the same problem sets with a very simple network, very simple services. But that's where sort of a lot of the standards and approaches and needs arose. But then the networks became more complicated and just got increasingly more and more complicated. And the solutions went all over the place. So that's why the fog of war, if you will, is so central to sort of, pointing the direction of solutions here.
No, thanks for the nod there. And I have had at least a half a dozen people, Tony, stop me in an elevator or in a hallway in a conference and say, "Oh, you're the fog guy." I'm not sure if I should be complimented or insulted, but the imagery resonated, right? And a couple said, I got it when you said that, and then that helped me frame the discussion with my boss, to bring more focus, right? And we need to not get, because the boss tends to fall in love with the latest whiz-bang, magic beans and magic box that his vendor friend that he knew in college wants to sell. And that just contributes to the problem. It doesn't solve the problem. And he was trying to get back to base. I need some foundational things that help me explain it. So that felt pretty good, that maybe I hit something that resonated. Listen, lots more to talk about. We're going to take a short break for business here. We'll be right back to the audience.
Sure.
Are you a U.S. state, local, tribal, or territorial government?
If so, just how difficult cyber defense can get.
You're the frontline defense against cyber threats, yet you don't have the shiny tools, big budget, or skilled talent of an enterprise.
Well, guess what? You don't need them.
You do need a community of like-minded folks to unlock the power of collective cybersecurity.
And that's the superpower of the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
The Multi-State ISAC provides cyber underserved organizations with protections they otherwise couldn't afford at a price that works for them.
But it's more than just access to services. It's access to a community of peers where your participation protects them and theirs protects you.
Not to mention access to the 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center as your full-time public sector cybersecurity partner.
Available as a single organization or state or territory-wide option, the MSISAC membership provides threat intelligence, monitoring, and more to fortify your cyber defense.
Become a member today by visiting cisecurity.org/ms-isac.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for sticking with us. Tony, one of the things I'd love to have you share with the audience here. So you could have a good idea like the controls or any recommendations or technical solution, but to make it embedded as part of the, I'll call it the infrastructure or the ecosystem, right? You spent a lot of your time working with things like standards bodies, professional organizations and so forth that sort of take technology and help reframe it in terms of public policy or the sort of larger structure. Can you talk a little bit about that process? So I guess my experience is good ideas almost never win on their own or never become sort of commonly implemented. It takes work, and you've been the master at sort of finding those places. Can you share a little bit of that with the audience?
Sure. In many ways, it's a bit like being an orchestral conductor because you've got all these kind of different pieces of the puzzle. You have the technology and the techniques in play. You have a set of players that either gain or lose in some cases from the implementations of those capabilities. You've got legal and regulatory norms, and like it or not, politics that you have to deal with. You have institutional constraints of all kinds, which has just gotten worse because in the cybersecurity field, in fact, we've got this kind of encyclopedia of all the cybersecurity organizations that I put together and is still maintained. There's literally, I think recently we came up with 700 different groups that are working on something related to cybersecurity. And so there's all this, it's a massive fog of stuff out there. And so what you want to do is convince people that the fog of more is real, and that this subset of actions that are prioritized are and can actually achieve something is basically what you want to do. So you basically find the right standards venues and basically map this stuff to everything else out there. You try and embed it and link it to regulatory mechanisms. Then you just convince people that, you know, there's a value proposition here. And I mean, the good news is that the controls are actually pretty ubiquitous globally and appreciated. And that's one of the kind of cool things here. It's
it was quite a revelation for us several years ago when the percentage of downloads that were originated from outside the U.S. exceeded those from inside. And that was essentially with no marketing, you know, with just attention to it. And it to us, it spoke to, number a hunger for that kind of information and the willingness to take, you know, we're U.S. based, but people didn't seem to have any problem trusting the work of CIS, right, as a independent source. And we're proud of that, right? We're both transparent in the way we do things. We build it through communities, which include lots of folks, and we make it available, you know, at no charge. So that really helps. But you know, your point there, a couple of quick things. One is that finding that timing, right, is something you've been masterful at, right? So that is because it's a bit of, you have to find people who are trying to solve a problem at a particular moment in a particular way. And sort of bring the right content that helps them see, oh yes, this is what we meant. You know, that rarely happens by accident, right? It's because you're involved in these things and you have, you know, the players, and you know, this is an ongoing conversation where these things come and go all the time. And as you said, many of the players that are involved with this, there might be hundreds, but they all have different motivations. You know, vendors want a place for their products, right? Nations want a place for them to dominate technology. You know, different standards bodies are looking to, you know, build self-perpetuating monopolies or whatever. There's all kinds of motivations all in play, and to be able to navigate is really quite a trick. And it takes time and, you know, the kind of relationships that you've built up over decades. So, yeah, it's always been impressive. But, you know, we should find a link and we'll share it with in the show notes here, because you have done by far, the first time you showed me your ecosystem diagram of all the playing, the companies and their relationships that are involved, or bodies that are involved in cybersecurity, it's like astounding, and a tremendous amount of research to pull all that together. And then, you know, now it's being maintained. It's really worth taking a look at, because it gives you the sense of the complexity of this problem, right? And
well, what's fun too is I started doing this in the early 80s when I suddenly became responsible for this stuff at the FCC, and I put together the first diagram. Then I said, you know, how does this all fit together? And I've basically reiterated that over the years. So I've got a 1990s version of that. I've got a 2000 version. It got so complex that the only thing I could do is maintain it on a spreadsheet.
Right. No, it's quite an amazing bit of work. But it's also, as you said, it's how few people appreciate that scale, right? And recognize all these different pieces, and think of them as points of influence, right? Who's creating regulatory structures and language and, you know, standards and so forth. And for us, you know, it's a small nonprofit. We have to kind of pick our battles, right? Pick the places where it makes sense. And again, you've been such a great advocate for us, helping us.
Well, and to give you and the CIS credit too. I mean, like Thomas Sager, who maintains the mapping of the controls to all these other frameworks, basically says two things: that we sort of understand that there's this huge ecosystem that we're a part of, and we're not the only ones. There are all these others that have the same interests and need and slight variances, but we're sort of recognizing what they're doing and mapping what we're doing to them. And CIS is the only one that does that.
No, thank you for pointing that, because that is something we're really proud of. We recognize that that is a problem, right? All this complexity, and we're willing to invest our resources to do something about it, to create authoritative maps from what we do. You know, we recognize, because I remember we did a survey with one of our vendor friends quite a few years ago, asking people, like, how many security frameworks do you have to deal with? Guess what? The answer is almost never zero or one. It's always multiples. And so how do you deal with that? How can you afford to do all these things in parallel? But if you actually, and we study this, in terms of the technical things that you need to do, there's a core of things that cut across essentially all of those. And so you don't want to do that same work multiple times. You want to do the work in a particular, you know, the right security improvement work, but be able to map it or represent it in the NIST CSF, right? In European standards, in PCI, ISO 27001. And so our willingness to both recognize and invest resources to simplify that problem. I mean, that is, you know, I think it's one of the most important things we do. So I'll pass the your kudos on to whoever that young fella is that takes care of all the mappings for CIS. I don't know if you, when we first brought him on, I said, you are now the chief cartographer of CIS. It's not official, but you're the map maker, you know. And we gave a talk, Here Be Dragons, navigating an ocean of security frameworks. You know, it was the first father-son technical talk we ever gave. So thanks for putting it out. Oh, so let me take you on a sort of where we are today. So for the audience, Tony has spent a lot of time with our team over the last several months. We've been and have just released a paper, Secure by Design. And it's a bit of a nod to some of the work of the prior administration of CISA and folks like Bob Lord in their Secure by Design campaign. And the notion is, right, push security, a significant part of security improvement earlier in the life cycle, design security and so forth. And this has been a theme for the entire history of computer security, but they really brought a fresh emphasis to it and so forth. But it was really kind of at the campaign level. You know, this is important. We need to do it. They established some principles for it. What we did was take the idea and kind of, you know, make it the CIS style, which is bring it down a notch in terms of implementation, measurement, and so forth. And Tony was an essential part of the team that's put that together. So, Tony, if you could share a little bit about that work, but most specifically, how you've taken that work now and carried it and made sort of institutionalize it, particularly in in European thinking and frameworks.
Sure. Actually, it's sort of really gone global. That was underscored by 2 weeks ago. We went to a global annual security conference and basically sort of introduced it to the world, what we were going to be doing, which basically marries the critical security controls, which is something that users typically need to implement, to the safe code controls for basically how you do safe coding, how you bring about better code. And so marrying those together is something that is just critically important going forward and quite complex. And so having Steve Lipner, who's sort of the Yoda of safe coding, with Tony Sager and Phyllis and the other in the CIS team, who are kind of the collective Yodas of the CIS controls, and making that a reality is just I think it's a tectonic change in the field of cybersecurity. I think it'll be viewed as a historical moment. So what I did is I took the guide that was rolled out that describes basically how to do this in kind of colloquial terms, and along with a complex spreadsheet, and morphed that into a formal global technical standard in the European Telecommunications Standards Institute, which despite its name actually is primarily a global standards body. It makes, amongst other things, all the standards for the global mobile networks. And that was rolled out. In fact, I introduced it today at a at an international meeting of the technical committee for cybersecurity, and everyone loved it. It will have actually a lot of embedding within it of mapping. So the value proposition here is it uses the same mechanism that the CIS used for implementation groups, only for development groups. So it says, if you only have this amount of resources, your SMA, you do these sorts of things. If you have more, group two, you do this. If you're three and you got lots of resources, you do this. So that's a lovely level of granularity that's really significant that no one else does. It also basically identified specific roles within entities that and you sort of tag these things to roles. So it has a whole bunch of features that are absolutely unique in the world of cybersecurity. So I think it's really going to be paradigm changing, and everyone loved it. You had security organizations from all over the world actually sort of expressing marvel at what had been rolled out.
Yeah, no, thanks. And thanks for mentioning SafeCode and the legendary Steve Lipner, you know, who is just an amazing resource and you know, has been spent a lifetime working about these kinds of things. That connection that you mentioned, right, between sort of the development practice and operational practice or operational management has always been something that's been missing and elusive. And yet they have to be interlocked. I remember, and when I first became aware of this, Tony, I'll share with you a story. I remember the common criteria stuff. And I know there was, I won't mention the big vendor, but there was a key vendor that was involved with this. And they had made it through, you know, the process, and they were going to do the whatever the name of the testing was. And my tech lead came back, and you know, he was peripherally involved, and he said, "Yeah, the people said we're about to test this thing." And the people, it was a contractor brought in to run the test. And they said, "Well, how do you want us to configure this?" And everybody looked around like, "We have no idea. We never thought about that." And my guy said, "Hey, NSA has a security guide, right, the predecessor to the controls and the CIS benchmark. Why don't you just set it up to that?" Hey, that's a good idea. But you know, the idea was we will build the better software, but we don't even know how to test it because no one's going to run it empty out of the box. You're going to set it up somehow, right? You're going to configure it for your operational needs and what you think the security problem is. But it always struck me like, you know, you can't think of one without the other, right? Because good design gives you the ability to manage things like attack surface and so forth. But if you don't, in practice, know how to run your system, manage it, configure it, turn all the knobs in the settings, then you've just undone all your security. And so you have to be able to kind of think of this as a continuum of activity. But it sounds like, you know, we hit the, I'd love to say we had this brilliant strategy, but maybe it was a little bit of blind luck too. The timing really feels perfect, Tony. You know, you mentioned the receptiveness, right? That it felt like people were, oh yeah, we needed to do something there, and you happened to be at the right moment at the right time with a, you know, with a product that was you know, came out of the team. So kudos to folks like Kurt Dukes, who really anticipated, I think, the need here, and you know, kind of he's our for the audience, he's our taskmaster who made us meet deadlines, and but it really has worked out in terms of attention, and I think it's a contribution, and like with all CIS things. We did not spend a year trying to polish to perfection. We think we gave it a really honest, professional, really good effort. And we expect it to evolve, right? We'll get feedback on it. But we've run it through lots of friends and trusted, you know, folks all around the world. And we've gotten really good feedback on it. So we're feeling really good about where we are today. But again, it's your efforts to take it, kind of the good idea, and then institutionalize it, right? Find folks who are... see that as a problem we're solving, and this content as something worth building that approach around. So it's been a wonderful experience, and thank you for the work that you've done with us to you know, to turn ideas into something specific.
Well, I'm just the orchestrator. I get one of the fun parts of my job is I get to work with the people who are real genius. So
too modest, my friend. Yeah. Tony, let's see. Which career are you on? You're in double digits, as near as I can tell, something like that.
Yes. Funny you should say changing careers. My mother always accused me of not being able to hold a job. In fact, I actually started out, they wanted me to be a physician. So I started, believe it or not, I went through 4 years of pre-med.
I didn't realize that. Okay. Well, you know, this cyber health, and I think maybe you wound up in the business, not in the way that was intended, but we appreciate the contributions you've made to our industry and to CIS. Again, Tony, and you, we've acknowledged you as one of our CIS controls ambassadors, and it's wonderful, but you know, it's a pretty humble designation relative to all the great work that you've done in this industry. So it's I know I can say on behalf of the CIS team, what an honor it is to work with you and a pleasure. We just have the best time swapping ideas, and we have been on parallel paths, have lots of stories that intersect in fun and interesting ways. So with that, we look forward to even more of the same. But any last thought you'd care to leave with the audience, Tony, as long as we have your attention and time here?
Only that this is an arena in which I think we're particularly now with some of this with the new platform is really exciting. If you want to do something that will continue to be exciting as a career over a long period of time, this is something to basically to become familiar with and to make happen.
Okay. Nope. I think there's great work ahead. And, you know, we both, I think, we have our moments, but we're both from that eternal optimist. We can do this school of thinking. And so that's why we've dedicated so much of our lives to trying to make the world a safer, a more secure place. So thank you again, Tony. And for our audience, thank you for your time and attention. As always, we don't take it for granted. We're always looking for your feedback, looking for topics of interest to you, and really, really appreciate that follow our conversations here. If you don't, please subscribe to us in all the usual ways, and we look forward to bringing some of these topics to light again in our next episode. So thank you again.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.